Seeking the light of God's Spirit on His Word, we turn again to that passage in John's Gospel, the 11th chapter, and we'll read again at the beginning. John chapter 11, reading at verse 1. Now a certain man was sick, named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha, and so on. Now, I intend, if we are spared, over the next 3 weeks, to look with you on Sabbath evenings at this family in Bethany. Martha, Mary, her sister, and their brother Lazarus. Now we'll look tonight at Lazarus, next Lord's Day at Martha, and then finally at Mary, and there's a reason for taking it in that order, which will perhaps become apparent as we go through it. Now, I don't need to say anything much by way of introduction. We are already familiar with the three names. We know from our reading of Scripture that they lived in the village of Bethany, which was near to Jerusalem. It appears that all three were unmarried at this stage. Beyond that, little is clear as to the home circumstances. But it is abundantly clear that they had an open home for the Lord and for the Lord's people. And that was the case not only when all was going well and when the crowds were glad to sing his praises, but that it was also the case when the storm clouds were approaching and Calvary was drawing near. I was thinking of them this week, and I was thinking, you know, you could almost imagine the three of them in our own congregation here. That's the way my mind was going on it. You can imagine them, and they would be the sort who would be present and there. You can imagine them sitting in the family pew, perhaps here on the Lord's Day, and over there in the hall on Wednesdays and Saturdays. You can imagine them at communions. They were a people who loved these things. And here, at the beginning of chapter 11, Lazarus is sick, very sick. And it's that sickness and the subsequent events that I want to focus on tonight. And there are two particular things that we'll look at. I want us to deal, first of all, and relatively briefly, with the sister's appeal. The sister's appeal. And we'll say three things about that. And then secondly, and more extensively, we'll deal with Jesus' response, or Jesus' appearance. And we'll extend more on that particular point. So we have the sister's appeal. We have the Lord's appearance. And we begin then with the sister's appeal. And I want to say just three things about it very simply. I want us to notice, first of all, the subject of their appeal. The subject of their appeal is obvious. It's Lazarus. Lazarus is sick. We're not told what sort of sickness it was, but very quickly it became obvious that their brother was very ill. And the sisters, they knew about the Lord's care. They knew about the compassion of his heart. And more crucially still, we have the testimony of their own lips in the chapter that they believed in the Lord's power. If thou hadst been here, my brother, they say, had not died. So they send for him. They send word that Lazarus was sick. Now, there are several instances in the Gospels of people sending for the Lord. I won't start going into them just now, but you'll remember some of them yourselves, and children, maybe you'll be able to remember some of them as well. And there's something terribly attractive about that. And I was wondering this week as I was pondering this chapter, I was wondering what we would do. I was wondering if you would send for him. I was wondering if you do send for him. I was wondering if that's where you turn to when trouble and difficulty and sorrows come in. Or do you fall back upon the weak, oh so weak, personal strength and abilities that we have? There's a lovely boldness in the sisters' appeal. They weren't appealing to a stranger that they had heard vaguely about. He wasn't a stranger to them, and they weren't strangers to him. And that's probably the crux of it, isn't it? Is he a stranger to you? And are you a stranger to him? Is he a stranger to your home? And is your home a stranger to him? If he is, then it's unlikely that that's where you turn to. It's unlikely that that's your source of help. And if that is the case, my friend, I think that should make you think. I know that should make you think. The sisters' appeal. But then secondly, we notice not only the subject of their appeal, but the basis of their appeal. He whom thou lovest, verse 3, is sick. The basis of their appeal is love. On the basis of love, they say, Lord, come and help. But did you notice? It's not Lazarus' love for the Lord that's the basis of their appeal, but the very opposite, the Lord's love for Lazarus. They don't say, Lord, he who loves you is sick. That was a truth. But there was a greater truth. He whom you love is sick. And the basis of their appeal, oh dear souls that they were, was his love and his commitment and his grace. As I read these words, my heart warms towards these two. For they had come to realize, albeit through a glass darkly, but they had come to realize that what counted wasn't their love to the Lord, weak and fluctuating as it is, but his unceasing love for his people. We love him, they could have said, because he first loved us. That's the basis of their appeal. And Christian friend, that's the basis of your appeal and of your turning to the Lord. Satan will say, how can you turn to the Lord? You're as unfaithful and fickle as the worst of them. And yes, you are. But what counts, and how often we make this point, and I can't make it too often, what counts is his faithfulness, his love, and the unchanging character of his covenant bond to his people. We have the subject of the appeal, we have the basis of the appeal, and thirdly, we have the reason for the appeal. Obviously, the reason was that the Lord would help, and if that were his will, heal their brother. But the point I want you to notice is this. They don't dictate what or how the Lord is going to do. They don't say, come and heal it. They don't suggest any method. They don't suggest any time scale. They come with a problem and they leave it all in his capable hands. And oh, there's a word of wisdom in that. The what and the how is left with him. Did you not tell him what to do? Did you not send Martha, Mary, did you not send in the message some direction, some guidance to him? No, they said, he doesn't need any from us. His wisdom, his grace is far in excess of anything that we might bring. We leave the solution in his wise hands. We come with a problem. And Christian friend, isn't there a lesson there? Isn't it often the case that we try and interfere and have a finger in the solution? As I was thinking it, I remembered Naaman. Now we mustn't be too hard on Naaman. He was a babe in the kingdom of Christ when he uttered these words, if he was even within the kingdom. But you remember he came to Elisha, the prophet, and Naaman had his own idea as to how the leprosy was going to be healed. He thought, well, the prophet will come out and he'll make a prayer and he'll do this, that and the next thing and he'll put his hand on the spot and... well, what a disappointment. Elisha didn't come out at all. Oh. Well, Elisha knew how to deal with haughty Syrian commanders. Didn't come out at all. There was a lesson in humbling that had to be learned by this man. He sent his servant out and he said, go and wash 7 times in the Jordan. And he was furious. Friends, isn't there a time when we say, I thought that the best solution for the problem was if the Lord would do this and if the Lord would do that. And we come with our own suggestions and our own ideas. Oh, what wisdom. What wisdom in this message from Bethany to bring it and to leave it. 100%. With himself. And the Lord's solution, here and so often, is quite different to our solution. You know, if you had asked Mary and Martha what they thought the Lord would do, they might have said, well, we think the Lord will come and he'll go in and he'll do this and the next thing. If you had said to them, the Lord will leave him till he's dead and after 4 days he'll call him out of the tomb, well, they would have said that would never have crossed our minds. But oh, what a glorious answer it was. But I mustn't get ahead of myself. The subject, the basis, and the reason for the appeal. He whom thou lovest is sick. But then secondly, we have the Lord's appearance. And there are 3 things I want to say about the Lord's appearance. And the first thing I want us to notice is this. His appearance was delayed. His appearance was delayed. So delayed, in fact, that Lazarus dies. The sisters send the message, and they watch anxiously. Probably day and night, catching moments of sleep. And it's obvious to them that Lazarus is sinking. And they've got one eye on the bed in which their brother lay and another eye on the window and the road down which the Lord would come. And he doesn't come. And he doesn't come the first day. And he doesn't come the second day. And perhaps one of them was asleep and woke up. And the first thing she said, how is Lazarus? Oh, he's poorly. And has he come? No sign of the Lord. And then eventually, with still no sign of the Master, Lazarus passes through what Spurgeon used to call the iron gates of death. Jesus' appearance was delayed. Now, we've all been delayed, time and again. But this chapter leaves us in no doubt that this delay was not accidental, but deliberate. Verse 6 and 7. When he heard therefore that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. Then after that saith he to his disciples, let us go into Judea again. And then verses 14 and 15. Then said Jesus unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there. He doesn't say, oh, I regret that I lingered. He doesn't say, I ought to have hastened and been faster. He doesn't say, oh, I didn't realize that Lazarus was so sick. No, he says, I am glad. Glad? Glad? Now, we'll see in a moment that he wasn't glad because Lazarus was dead. He was glad for other reasons. But oh, what questions this delay must have caused. Oh, they must have been, they would have had to be superhuman not to have been questions. Maybe they didn't voice them. Maybe they were so loyal to the Lord. Maybe they were so committed to Him that they didn't say a word to the company in the house. But oh, who would believe that Satan didn't have a field day with Mary and Martha? You can imagine him. Can imagine the thoughts. Why did he not come? What made him so apparently unconcerned? They have no doubt that had he come, they might have been spared this terrible sorrow. Martha in verse 21 and Mary in verse 32 say exactly the same thing. Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. And you know, there's been many a Martha and a Mary since then who waited long for answers to prayer. There's been many a Martha and a Mary since then who've pled and who wondered at the silence of heaven. Many's a Martha and a Mary since then who felt delay and maybe who are even tonight disappointed and discouraged. Who are asking as we sang in Psalm 77, is it true that to be gracious the Lord forgotten hath, and that his tender mercies he hath shut up in his wrath? Forever is his mercy gone, fails his word evermore. So it was a delayed appearance. But though it was a delayed appearance, it was also a decisive appearance. It was a decisive appearance. Now, that's a word maybe that children you aren't so familiar with. Well, decisive really means that it made all the difference. And friend, when he comes into our life, and into a family, and into a situation, he makes all the difference. His appearance whether it's delayed or not, is always decisive. It transforms everything. And when he comes, he turns grief into gladness and death into life. And if you're here in a Christless state, I tell you, he can do the same for you. Imagine if they'd shut the door in his face. Imagine if word had come to Martha, the Master is come. And she'd said, the Master, I don't want to see him. Imagine if Mary had agreed, and he had come and the door was closed. What a blessing they would have lost. Oh, friend, with the closed door of the heart, what a blessing you forfeit. For his coming into your experience would be a transforming arrival. Every bit as transforming as this one. It's decisive. Because he comes not just as a friend, not just as a comforter to help them. He comes as the giver of life and as the raiser of dead. Don't confuse this point. We need Christ not merely to cheer up our lives. We need him to raise us up to new spiritual life out of the grave of our lost condition. Sometimes there can be a presentation of the gospel which misses this point, that speaks of the Lord coming and bringing cheer and all the rest of it to life. And that's true. Of course it's true. But I will do you a grave disservice if you sit under my ministry and you think that that is all that the Lord is going to bring, that he's going to brighten up your day and make things better. Whatever he might do in that regard, the primary reason you need him isn't to make life more tolerable, but to give you spiritual life in place of death. There were plenty others who could comfort the sisters, and they were doing it in the chapter. But there was only one who could come and transform the situation as he does. And there is still only one who can come into hearts and lives and souls and families and transform it. In this way, his coming was decisive. They think he's come too late. They think he's come at the wrong time, but he hadn't. He had come at the right time, and he had answered in the right way. Oh, discouraged and disconsolate Christian friend, this passage reminds you, and it reminds me, that the Lord's way and the Lord's time is higher and, yes, better than our way. You remember Joseph, forgotten and left in the prison. Is it true, Joseph, that to be gracious the Lord forgotten hath, and that his tender mercies he hath shut up in his wrath? Is it true, Joseph? No, 1,000 times, no! The Lord's time for Joseph had not yet come. Jesus' appearance was delayed, but Jesus' appearance was decisive. And thirdly, when it came with deliverance. Lazarus, come forth. Three things about this deliverance. First of all, it was a powerful deliverance. They would have spoken of it the length and breadth of the district. You imagine if it were to happen up there in the graveyard at Skabos. We become so used to these miracles. We read about them and we don't think anything about them. Place yourself in it for a moment. Imagine if we were to be gathered up there at the graveyard. And one was to be present who was to call by name one individual in the parish of Snizort who had died, and that person came out. There would be nothing ordinary or commonplace about it. Supposing you lived for 100 years, you would say at the end of 100 that it was the most astonishing thing you had ever witnessed. Oh, it was a powerful deliverance. But equally powerful is the deliverance that the Lord works in the souls of men and women when he delivers them from the tomb of a lost and spiritual condition. John 5, verse 25 or 24. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. Oh, there's Lazarus is aplenty, still about. Those who were dead in trespasses and sins, who were lying dead, immobile and senseless in the grave of their lost, ruined, sinful condition, who had neither power nor will to come forth, who were lying there in all the putrefying corruption of their lostness, until they were called, until the life came where there was only death. Oh, what a powerful deliverance. And friends, there's no doubting who had the power. Was it a case of half the Lord and half Lazarus? Did the Lord come and supply 50% of the power and Lazarus the other 50%? Of course not. It was entirely Christ. And the same is true spiritually. It is entirely dependent upon the work of heaven. He called, and with the call, he enabled Lazarus to live again, to walk again, to talk again. And the same is true spiritually. He calls, and with the call, he enables men and women to embrace Jesus Christ, freely offered in the gospel. And Jesus called, and he that was dead came forth. Yes, it was a powerful deliverance, but it was also a personal deliverance. I'm imagining just now Lazarus, months later, maybe a year or two later, and he's away from Bethany and he meets a stranger and they get into conversation. And the stranger realizes that the man is from Bethany, this Lazarus that he's met. And he says, oh, he said, I've heard of your tongue. Have you heard of this Jesus, who they say was able to raise the dead. Oh, yes, says Lazarus, I've heard of it. I've more than heard of it. He raised me. Has it become a personal deliverance in your experience? Or they might say, oh, I saw Lazarus. I spoke to him after he rose. Well, that's very good. But that wouldn't do their souls any good. It was a powerful deliverance. It was a personal deliverance. And it was a perfect deliverance. It was a perfect deliverance. The clear impression we have is that Lazarus came out of that tomb as easily as he got out of bed. Now I know he was bound hand and foot with grave clothes and they had to release him in that sense. But he didn't crawl out slowly. He didn't crawl out painfully on his hands and knees, still hovering at death's door. Oh, I believe that he came out a well man. Because you see, God's work is a perfect work, and his spiritual work is also a perfect work. It was a perfect deliverance. And so, Christian friend, was yours. Oh, you say, I don't feel very perfect. Huh. Of course you don't. There's two principles at work in your soul, and they're fighting one with another. That's hardly going to make for a rest of life. But how often do we say, it has nothing to do with what you feel? A powerful, personal, perfect deliverance. His appearance was delayed, it was decisive, but oh, when it came with deliverance. And we go back to these words in verse 15. I am glad for your sakes. He knew that ultimately the delay and the disappointment would lead to a strengthening of faith in the disciples, in Mary and Martha, not to mention Lazarus himself. My friend, the Lord will screen you from many's a trial and many's a disappointment. But he will not screen you from those that are a means of strengthening of faith. But there's something else, and I know the time has gone, but I must make the point. He calls him out of the tomb. And the Lord knew that very soon after this, he himself would be laid in a tomb. And he knew that he would not be delivered from death and its powers. Indeed, he refused any suggestion of deliverance. He would die as the Lamb of God and as the substitute. He would be laid in the tomb. And a borrowed one of that. And by his dying, sinful men and women who would trust in him would be delivered from the tomb of their lost spiritual condition. He who had the power to summon life had also the power to dismiss his spirit and bow his head and give up the ghost. And here we are in the realm of mystery. And we take off our shoes because it's holy ground. And he knew that he too would rise. And today he is the risen Lord. And soon he will return. And soon he will call not just from one grave, but from all our graves. And the dead shall stand before God. And on that day, blessed are those who can say, we love him because he first loved us. And blessed are those who can say, I have risen from this earthly tomb, but before I ever went into it, I rose from the tomb of my lost spiritual condition. I had a first resurrection before the second. Well, that's Lazarus. If we're spared, we'll come back. And we'll meet the sisters in greater detail. But I want to leave you tonight with something that John Owen, the great Puritan writer, said. He was dying. And he had a friend in, and the friend was writing a letter that John Owen was dictating. What shall I tell them? He said. Tell them, he said, that I am still in the land of the living. No, no, he said. No, change that, he said. Tell them that I am still in the land of the dying, but I will soon be in the land of the living.